Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Hello and glad you could join us here at Africa Link. Live from Bonn, Germany, I'm Crispin Mwakideu.
And I'm Silla Oneko, bringing you Africa's trending hashtags and what you have to say about the stories we've been covering.
And here's what's coming up on this edition of Africa Link. Kenyan police beat anti-corruption protesters in Nairobi.
And on social media, the hashtag resign, act on corruption or resign has been trending in Kenya.
And the battle for Mosul, Iraqi forces step up their offensive to recapture Mosul from IS militants.
If one violated their rule, he or she would be beaten or pushed off of a building. If they discovered a spy or a police officer, they would decapitate the person immediately.
Stay tuned for all that and more, but before that, here's a chance to find out what's been happening around the globe.
I'm Mark Caldwell with the DW News. England's High Court has ruled that the British government cannot start the process of leaving the European Union without the approval of Parliament. The court said the government itself does not have the power to trigger Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty, which is the formal notification of Britain's intention to leave the EU. Speaking in the House of Commons, Trade Secretary Liam Fox said the government was disappointed by the judgment.
The country voted to leave the European Union in a referendum approved by Act of Parliament. The government is determined to respect the result of the referendum. This judgment raises important and complex matters of law, and it's right that we consider it carefully before deciding how to proceed.
In the German capital Berlin, police have arrested a man suspected of being a member of the Islamic State militant group. The man, who claims to be 27 and from Syria, was taken into custody on Wednesday evening. The German news agency DPA said he had been under surveillance by Germany's domestic security service for some time. Interior Minister Thomas de Maizière praised the detention, saying it showed that German authorities were vigilant and doing everything possible to prevent terrorist attacks. In the Kenyan capital Nairobi, hundreds of people have taken to the streets to protest against the abuse of public funds in healthcare. The health ministry denies the charges. This protester told Reuters Television the demonstration also reflected wider unease with slow progress generally in the fight against corruption.
It's also an event that is really meant to bring to the fore the failure of our government, the failure of our president, who publicly indicated that he is not able to do anything against corruption.
Police beat the anti-corruption protesters with batons and fired tear gas to disperse them. This news comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany. South Africa's Justice Minister has presented a bill in Parliament to repeal the country's membership of the International Criminal Court. South Africa announced its intention to leave the court last year after the ICC criticised it for disregarding an order to arrest Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir. There's been another blow to international efforts to fight climate change. The United Nations said on Thursday that greenhouse gas emissions in 2030 are expected to be far in excess of the maximum permitted levels necessary to keep global warming in check. Emissions in 2030 are set to reach the equivalent of 56 billion tonnes of carbon dioxide. That's well above the 42 billion tonne ceiling, below which global warming can be kept within 2 degrees Celsius this century. A new global climate pact, agreed in Paris, goes into force tomorrow. For more news and information, please visit our website, DW.com. I'm Mark Caldwell.
Beaten for speaking out, Kenyan police today fired tear gas and beat anti-corruption protesters in the capital, Nairobi. The demonstrators were calling on President Uhuru Kenyatta to act on corruption or resign. The protest was organized by civic society groups who have been pressuring the government to act on graft. DW's Africa Links correspondent Andrew Wasike was among those who had to endure some of the tear gas, but he still managed to send us this report.
Thousands of Kenyans from all walks of life gathered at Uhuru Park in the Kenyan capital Nairobi to demonstrate against a rise of corruption in the East African country. The protesters were clad in red t-shirts while others came wearing prison uniforms with their hands chained to wooden doors to create a detention scene. They chant slogans and blew whistles as they waited for the crowd to grow bigger before leaving for State House in Nairobi, where they intended to give a petition to Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta on how best to handle corruption. No sooner had the organizers finished their speeches than police fired tear gas canisters at the crowd. The police that had surrounded Uhuru Park moved in to disperse the crowds. Some protesters were not so lucky as they were beaten up by the baton-wielding policemen. Julius Malombe, the deputy director of the Kenya Human Rights Commission, urged President Kenyatta to resign if he can't fight corruption.
We're here to fight corruption. As human rights organizations, we've looked at the laws of Kenya, and we have seen that the president has the main obligation and powers to deal with this problem in the country. And we are telling him that we are giving him 14 months failure until we are going to tell him to pack and go.
Martha Karua, a Kenyan politician and a former presidential candidate, said that Kenyans were dismayed by the alleged disappearance of public funds meant to cater for the treatment of women, children and the people living with disabilities.
Theft of public monies meant to improve health and general service delivery to vulnerable citizens, especially pregnant women and young children. We wish to make the following demands as consistent with our constitutional rights to information. One, full disclosure of all data of the beneficiary companies involved in the Appiah House scandal, including special interest groups.
As the protests gained momentum in Nairobi, former Devolution Cabinet Secretary Anne Waiguru spent the better part of Thursday answering queries on corruption allegations from the National Assembly Public Accounts Committee.
Honorable Chairperson, Engineer Nicholas Gumbo, honorable members of this esteemed committee, I appear before you in response to the summons issued on 24th October 2016. Let me take this opportunity to thank this committee for inviting me to shed more light on the matter of financial irregularities in the National Youth Service.
21 government officials have been named in the National Youth Service scandal report, which revealed that 791 million Kenya shillings was lost in suspicious payments to various private companies in Kenya.
Andrew Wasike reporting in Nairobi.
Now, the big name on the Kenyan social media scene is Boniface Mwangi. I mean, he's one of the organizers of the protest. And if you haven't heard of him, he's an activist, very vocal on corruption and on human rights violations in Kenya. And he's definitely a big opinion maker when it comes to Twitter, or influencer, as we say in social media lingo.
Influencer. Well, that's quite a title, I would say. We seem to be learning something new every day.
Yeah, exactly. And Boniface Mwangi and his team started the hashtag Act on Corruption or Resign, the message to President Uhuru Kenyatta. And they asked Kenyans to come out wearing red. And so there are lots of pictures on social media about people wearing red. And the protests are also very visual, with people wearing masks with a Kenyan flag and some dressed up as prisoners because they say they're prisoners of this corrupt system that they live in.
What I remember Boniface is when he brought the pigs to Parliament,
exactly, yeah.
You know, when they were demonstrating against that. Anyway, we have to leave it there. But still on Kenya, but on another developing story, the United Nations has said it values the Kenyan contribution to its peacekeeping mission in South Sudan, known as UNMISS. This comes after Nairobi said it was pulling out its troops from UNMISS. And Kenya was angered by UN Chief Ban Ki-moon's decision to fire a Kenyan general who was leading the mission. The UN chief blamed the general for failing to protect civilians during the July clashes which occurred in Juba. DW's Carol Robbie has been speaking to Mwenda Mbijiwe, a Kenyan security consultant for South Sudan's government.
As a Pan-Africanist, one that is concerned with the security of the region, I am deeply perturbed and disturbed by this development. And I say, for me, I would term it as the most unfortunate happening ever to happen in the region. And I wish we could have a better way to do this, but unfortunately, this has happened and there seems to be no point of return on.
Kenya has contributed around 1,000 soldiers, making it one of the largest national components in UNMISS. Don't you think by withdrawing from South Sudan, it will really, really impede the peace process in South Sudan?
Absolutely. Without a shadow of doubt, it's going to affect the peace process. In fact, Kenya went further to say even the nation itself will withdraw its diplomatic team from the entire peace process. So this has completely rocked the boat of the peace process in South Sudan. But this is what the UN has wanted. The UN command in South Sudan, the office of the United Nations in South Sudan, is commanded by one of the most arrogant teams ever anywhere on this earth. In fact, as a security consultant working closely with the government of South Sudan, I know very intimately that some of the problems that have bedeviled South Sudan peace process, from the IGAD discussion in Addis Ababa to the peace agreement, is because the UN command in South Sudan is a very biased team of UN officials, and I completely, you know, detest the fact that they decided to sideline the Kenyan military command from this decision that they made. It's very, very unfortunate.
At this point, could there be a compromise between Kenya and the UN?
That is what I would expect. Kenya is the aggrieved party. After Kenya's military decision, the UN should have reached out in peace. For goodness sake, we know United Nations is a peace entity. So they should have reached out, amicable, or rather, mending process between Kenya and themselves. But look, what they did is this. I'm driving from home and I received a news alert here that the UN has accepted that the Kenyan military withdraw. I mean, this is arrogance of the highest level. The UN needed to behave differently. Reach out to the president. The UN Secretary General could call the Kenyan president. They could call the Kenyan command, military command, and say, hey, this is not as bad as it is. Let's resolve this. If there are mistakes, let's correct them and let's have some peace. This is absolutely disgusting, the way the UN has handled this situation in South Sudan. And by the way, it looks like when the Kenyan military left, they were like, good riddance. We needed them to get the hell out of here. And they seem happy about it.
Kenyan security consultant Mwenda Mbijiwe, you are listening to DW's Africa Link from Bonn. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, leader of the so-called Islamic State, has called on his supporters to defend the Iraqi city of Mosul by any means necessary. For 2 weeks, Iraqi forces backed by Shia militia and Kurdish Peshmerga fighters have been battling to recapture the besieged city. As Malte Rovia Kalman now reports, Iraqi forces have freed several villages already.
Men shaved the thick beards they had been forced to grow in the so-called Islamic State. They are now free. Those who escaped the militant regime, like Ali Hamid, spoke of the life inside.
If one violated their rule, he or she would be beaten or pushed off of a building. If they discovered a spy or a police officer, they would decapitate the person immediately.
Over 1 million civilians are still trapped in Mosul, where the Islamic State group seized power 2 years ago. Their so-called caliphate had at one point stretched over large parts of northern Iraq and Syria, but military efforts pushed the group back. Mosul, it's now its last big stronghold in Iraq. But the Islamic State group's leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, urged his supporters to fight to the end. The UN Security Council warned that IS fighters might use civilians as human shields. Gori Sis, the Senegalese deputy ambassador.
The members of the Security Council condemn the use of human shields and call on all parties to take all feasible precautions with a view to avoiding harm to civilians.
IS fighters are also expected to resort to booby traps and suicide bombers to defend the city. It seems the hardest part in the fight for Mosul has just begun.
Malte Rovia Kalman reporting.
And to take you back to our main African story, the Kenyan protests, there's another interesting image, Crispin, that I've been seeing around the Kenyan protests on Twitter. And that's an image by the Kenyan cartoonist Gado.
And Gado, whose real name is Godfrey Mampemba, just visited us here in Bonn this week.
That's right. And he drew a caricature of President Uhuru Kenyatta dressed up as Marie Antoinette. That's the last queen of France who, when her people were hungry and protesting, famously said the words, "If you don't have bread, why don't you eat cake?"
Well, although to be fair to the lady, there was no proof that he actually said those words.
Exactly.
But well, we have to leave it there for now, Sela, although it's a very interesting topic to still proceed on. And coming up in the next quarter of an hour here at Africa Link, embattled Presidents Zuma and Mugabe vow to strengthen bilateral ties.
And we'll tell you all about media freedom in Germany and how we see it.
So stick around for these stories, plus young African Americans from a violent hit neighborhood of Chicago question whether life has anything good to offer. Before we answer that question, let's head to Zimbabwe, where President Robert Mugabe and his South African counterpart, Jacob Zuma, today attended the inaugural session of the South Africa-Zimbabwe Binational Commission. The two neighboring countries have good bilateral relations which date back to the liberation struggle. DW's correspondent Privilege Mushaniri was present during a press briefing, and I asked him what the two leaders had come up with.
Basically, what they did was to read solidarity messages and also to talk about the bilateral agreements that Zimbabwe and South Africa have signed in the past. But those bilateral agreements have not been actioned since 1995 when they were signed. What they did today was to sign a couple of more bilateral agreements like the civil aviation and air services bilateral agreement, the defense bilateral agreement. But in terms of anything that is quite tangible for actioning, we wait to see whether there will be things that may come, because of course Zimbabwe and South Africa are major trading partners. We have about 120 companies, South African companies, that are operating in Zimbabwe. So the balance of trade is kind of tilted towards South Africa. So I think South Africa is also looking at is to increase its presence and business in Zimbabwe.
Both President Zuma and Mugabe are under immense pressure to resign. So how much interest is there on the public on what these two leaders, are trying to achieve?
I will tell you that at the ceremony today, it was only government, representatives, mostly the Zimbabwean cabinet and the South African cabinet. We don't really know the closed-door meetings that were happening during the week from Monday, because there was a delegation that came ahead of Zuma to come and have meetings. But in terms of the ordinary people in Zimbabwe, it's business as usual. It's not something that, people were even talking about. It's just, if people were talking about this meeting, it was about President Zuma's, what he's facing at home, what people have been reading in the news, and what people saw yesterday happening in South Africa.
Privilege Mushaniri in Harare. Uzon. Chicago's South Side neighborhood became famous when President Barack Obama was elected 8 years ago. The Obamas did a lot of community work in the struggling neighborhood, which has a large African American community. Obama's election gave people hope, but now, 8 years later, Chicago and especially the South Side is more violent than ever. Young people are struggling, but still clinging on to hope. Laura Posma met some of the young people there and sent us this report.
This year alone, more than 3,000 people have been shot and killed in Chicago. A lot of these shootings are happening in the South Side, a neighborhood mostly inhabited by African Americans who struggle with poverty, unemployment, and poor housing. They live largely segregated from the rest of the city. It is here where a lot of gang violence is taking place, and where young people who grow up in this environment are constantly questioning if there is something better out there for them.
I have definitely been discouraged so many times. This is where, like, am I ever going to be anything? Am I worth anything? Am I just a black kid from the South Side of Chicago who's just following the footsteps of everybody else? So it's definitely doubts that sometimes, well, maybe I am, you know.
This is 18-year-old Nina Richardson. She was born in the South Side neighborhood of Inglewood. Nina says growing up being surrounded by violence makes it difficult to stay out of trouble when you are young. But Nina has found a way to turn her life into something positive. She is now a freshman in college and she wants to become a nurse. In her free time, she is taking a theater class at the South Side Community Arts Center. The South Side Community Arts Center is the place where I'm meeting Nina. I am visiting the theater class Teen Theater Talk. There are 8 teenagers between 14 and 18 years old. Through the theater class, the teenagers are able to express themselves and discover their talents. It gives them confidence and a place to feel safe.
From the top of the tea to the tip of the tongue.
The class is being given by 25-year-old Natalie Battles, who works at the Southside Community Arts Center. Natalie took the teen theater talk herself from the age of 15. She has been coming to the center ever since and now also works there as the office manager. Natalie gives me a short tour of the art center.
Look at the walls. They're literally plastered with little tiny holes from all the nails, from all
A lot of the artworks currently in the exhibition, called The Promise of Peace, are political. There are references to gun violence against African Americans by the police, and also here and there the name of U.S. presidential candidate Donald Trump shows up. The South Side became famous outside of the United States when Barack Obama was elected president in 2008. Barack and Michelle Obama did community work in the South Side and were very well known and loved in the community. Obama's election created a wave of hope and pride in the South Side. However, 8 years later, the situation hasn't improved that much. Nina's 18 years old, which means she would be able to vote for the first time this election. But she says she wasn't able to register in time, and therefore she cannot actually cast a ballot on November 8th. But she says it doesn't matter. This election got her so frustrated that she probably wouldn't have voted anyway.
It's like almost a joke. From the very beginning, I think that it's nothing is equal, nothing is fair. Hillary, I just think she is a good candidate, but I think underneath all of that, it's like... It sounds good, but you know, once she, if she really is elected in office, what's really going to change, you know?
The topics in this election in the United States seem to go by the issues that many people are actually struggling with. For example, the racial segregation and violence that people in the South Side of Chicago deal with every day. Especially for young people, it is difficult to make it out of that environment and work on a positive future.
That report was compiled by Laura Postma.
And people are really talking about the U.S. elections all around the world. I mean, it's just one less than a week ago. And what got Nigerians talking today was a comment by Wole Soyinka, the famous Nigerian playwright, poet, Nobel Literature Prize laureate. And he told students at Oxford University that if Trump becomes the president of the U.S., Soyinka will give up his green card. So everybody was sharing that article and articles about him on that.
Very, very interesting.
Speaking out.
Left in limbo, the Rwanda Media Commission RMC, the independent self-regulatory mechanism for Rwandan media, is once again shrouded in controversy after elections for the institution's leadership were postponed. Critics say this is a result of government's meddling. The delay has left many members of the media fraternity uncertain about the future of the institution, with many questioning its independence. This week, media watchdog Reporters Without Borders listed Rwanda's President Paul Kagame as one of the media freedom predators. From Kigali, DW's correspondent Nasra Bishumba reports.
When the Rwanda Media Commission was formed in 2013 and given autonomy, many journalists were excited that finally there was hope for an independent media industry in Rwanda. But their excitement was short-lived. Since its inception, the institution has been mired with controversy, with many blaming its challenges on the strong grip of the media by the government. Previously, journalists elected the chairperson directly. But according to a new proposal, journalists would be expected to elect board members of the media commission, who in return will elect the chairman. Many journalists are afraid that their rights would be infringed on if they are not allowed to elect a leader of their choice directly. The executive secretary of the Rwanda Journalists Association, Gonzaga Muganwa, explained why the elections were delayed.
They were delayed because of some factors, including interference. I'm not at liberty to go into the details, but it's normal, it's expected, especially in a sensitive media institution like this one. There are always converging interests. The job is to negotiate them to make sure that, number one, the law is followed. Journalists decided are followed.
Muganwa also thinks that no one should interfere with the choices journalists have to make when it comes to electing their leaders.
Journalists, of course, elect the person who reflects their ideas, who's like them. And most of the time they elect an activist who may not be preferred by certain political powers. But we strongly think it is within the right of journalists to choose whom they think can run the self-regulatory body best. It's very important the commissioners who are elected are able to negotiate the different interests and hear complaints without being biased.
Gerard Mbanda is the head of media and communication at the Rwanda Governance Board, which oversees media development among other responsibilities. He told me that though the government supports the Media Council, it does not meddle in any of its internal decisions. He instead blamed other foreign elements for sabotaging the good functioning of the media industry in Rwanda.
You cannot create something and then turn around and frustrate it. We support them so that they can work well. If they can be able to support themselves, go. So it's not contradictory at all. Ask other media organizations, you'll find they all receive some different kinds of support from the government. But does not mean that the government owns them. If there is any delay, it's them to know the reasons why. There are people who don't want the good functioning of media in this country. We revised our media law. We removed all the stringent articles.
Due to the sensitivity of the matter, many journalists preferred not to comment. The Rwandan government has on several occasions been accused by human rights organizations for harassing, threatening, and imprisoning journalists.
Nasra Bishumba reporting from Kigali.
And, well, on social media, there were not a lot of Rwandans out there talking about press freedom and so on, but we did have a question on Facebook from a follower called Karabito Matthias Hürleskamp, who asked, how free is media in Germany?
Now that's one for us directly, Sela.
Exactly. And Karabito, I mean, all I can say from my personal experience here at DW is that we never really have anybody breathing down our necks about our reporting, and we try to check our facts and verify things if they don't come from our own correspondence. But as long as the facts are there, we can generally report about people and events, no matter how high up in politics and government it gets, or in business for that matter, when you think of South Africa with the Guptas and so on.
That's true. That's very true. And we also take a look at the Press Freedom Index. And so, you know, it's not just our opinion here that we are trying to give. And worldwide, Germany is only on position 16 from the top. Apparently, Scandinavian countries, but even Jamaica and Costa Rica, shockingly, are doing better than Germany.
I know, that's surprising. Yeah. I mean, you kind of think you have a very free press here in Germany, but the explanation that that the Reporters Without Borders give is that there's been growing harassment and threats against journalists who are covering right-wing demonstrations and talking about right-wing radical groups like Pegida, who've been marching in Germany since last year, since the big kind of wave of refugees came,
right.
Started coming to Germany after the Syrian conflict. And another point that they also make is that the police can actually spy on journalists and find out their sources. And that's something that's been happening since 2009, where an anti-terrorism law was put into place.
Exactly. And I think that's a very, very sensitive issue here in Germany, you know, all this spying and how free should the media, or I mean, freedom of the media that is guaranteed in the Constitution, but how they monitor, you know, people's lives. I think it's a very, very sensitive.
Exactly, how they can tap phones, perhaps, and even give information to other countries like the US, like with what we saw with the NSA scandals and the reports released from Snowden.
Precisely. Well, Sela, is there any other thing that was trending today on Africa?
Well, as always, this whole week, South Africa's been talking about the state capture report on Zuma and the Guptas that came out yesterday. And, I mean, there's a lot of that out there. People are discussing it and people are basically posting whole chunks of the report. But we'll be monitoring for that for you, and we'll bring you more on that in the coming days and next week probably again.
So Zuma is on his way probably, or has already arrived in South Africa, but there's still a very, very, you know, strong storm brewing in his own
country. Yeah, lots of resistance in his country.
Anyway, before we go, here's a reminder of our main stories. Kenyan police today fired tear gas to disperse anti-corruption demonstrators in Nairobi. And we've also been hearing about the visit to Zimbabwe by South African President Jacob Zuma. And in other news, a Nigerian court has convicted four firms allegedly used by a former aide of former President Goodluck Jonathan to launder $15.5 million in suspected stolen funds. And Uganda told the UN Rights Council on Thursday that it does not tolerate discrimination based on sexual orientation, but this claim goes against the government's widely condemned record on gay rights. And the prices of oil have slightly gone up in what observers say is due to the pipeline attack in Nigeria and a weaker dollar. Thank you for listening, and hope you join us again same time tomorrow. From me, Crispin Mwakideu.
And I'm Sela Oneko, and we're looking forward to your comments on DW Africa on Facebook.
Take care and goodbye.